That dang Darjamel thinks he can weasel out of doing my show just because he's busy. Work and deadlines? Work and deadlines? What the hell kind of crappy excuse is that? Oh, okay, that's actually a pretty good excuse, isn't it? Well, I actually just emailed him back. Ah, come on. We'll see if that works. Yeah, maybe not. Oh, well. Well, lucky you, I'm going to do a lot of talking on the show today because I got a really late start. The dog got in a fight with a much bigger dog. She's fine. Anyway, yeah, I've been busy this morning. I do have Phil Giralli, who's got a new piece on uns.com about Palestine. It's called Americans Should Be Ashamed. All right. I'm going to hear you out. I'm interested in that. Yeah. Gareth Porter's got a new one out. This is not going to be new for you regular listeners, but it is going to be pretty damn good and interesting for everyone, I think, whether you've heard it before or not. Gareth on his new piece, In the National Interest. I'm so happy to see Gareth being published in the National Interest. He ought to be taken much more seriously at much, you know, quote-unquote, so-called type, whatever you say, higher levels of American foreign policy, this and that. He's the great debunker of everything that they believe. So you can see why he's not too often welcome. But his book, you know, I never heard anybody challenge the facts of his book, Manufactured Crisis, where, you know, he really puts the he really puts it all down. 25, 30 years worth of disinformation about Iran and their nuclear program. He straightens it all out. It's extremely valuable. If you haven't read it, you should. Anyway, here he is. He certainly earned a very high place at these councils, even if he doesn't get them yet. But here he is at the National Interest. The Fog of Diplomacy, Creating a False Picture of the Iran Nuclear Talks. And chances are this will be on antiwar.com tomorrow. Maybe even today. I don't know. Anyway, so Gareth Porter. And you know, I know it's 2014. It's no longer 2006 or 7, which seems like it was the greatest threat that we would actually have a war with Iran was around then. It's not the biggest threat. However, it is the big fake threat, the outstanding issue, even if it's not real. Even if the Iranians never were making nuclear weapons in the first place. Even if there's a very small percent chance that they would even decide to. And especially if we were to back off. If the whole thing is a manufactured crisis, it's still the crisis that is preventing some kind of rapprochement. Some type of warming up of relationships. The relationship between America and Iran. And I don't want America to go to war on the side of Iran in Iraq again. I don't want to be allies with them in doing horrible things to people or anything like that. I just want to see a cooling off of relations and an opening of trade so that everybody can make more money. Sanctions will be lifted. Their people be able to import the medicine that they need because, you know, America's preventing them from being able to do that a lot of the time now. It's not that they have an outright ban on medicines, but every bank in the world is terrified of doing business with any business that's doing business with Iran. And so there's a chilling effect, you might say, where nobody wants to tangle with the U.S. Treasury Department. And so it doesn't matter whether it's just a ship full of hot pants or not. It doesn't get delivered, along with the chemotherapy medicine, too. Anyway. That way they can get their sanctions lifted and we can, it'll be that much harder for the Israelis to drum up a real crisis between America and Iran in the future. That's the deal. It'll be ratcheting down tensions to a great degree because you can make all kinds of accusations against Iran. But the one that's effective, the one that scares the hell out of American soccer moms is they're going to nuke you in your jammies in the middle of the night. maybe we ought to go ahead and start the war. To prevent that, smoking gun could be a mushroom cloud and all of that kind of thing. It's such an emergency that you can't take the time to see whether I'm telling the truth or not. That kind of thing. Take away the nuclear threat and, we can work out whatever's the deal. Oh, they back Hamas. Well, that's pretty bad, I guess, but, you know, whatever. We can negotiate that. Anyway, that's what I want to see. I don't want to see America on the side of the Sunnis against the Shia, or on the side of the Shia against the Sunnis, or any more intervention in the Middle East at all. Only an end to it. So, again, I'm not calling for any kind of alliance with the Ayatollah, even though America really did fight the Iraq War for the Iranians and their sock puppets and the Dawa Party and Supreme Islamic Council. We've been their best allies over the last decade, even if we've been calling them our enemy all this time. But, yeah. And then, isn't it funny how, I don't know if that Barack Obama thinks he's smart or what, but here he spent all this time back in the Mujahideen after a fashion. Yeah, it's not very plausible deniability, really. Been back in the Mujahideen against Assad in Syria. Why? Just to take Iran down a peg. Well, hell, if we can get this nuclear deal, then it won't really matter. Hell, we've already fought a whole war for them. If we can get this nuclear deal, then we could be friends. We wouldn't have to be upset that Assad is backed by Iran at all. And again, I don't think we should be supporting Assad, but we sure as hell shouldn't be supporting the Mujahideen against him. For crying out loud. And especially when, as we know, because Barack Obama, the President of the United States, said it himself to Jeffrey Goldberg in an interview that presumably took place in the Oval Office, that the reason, I don't think presumably, I think it was reported that way, that the interview took place in the Oval Office. And Barack Obama said, secret things I can't tell you all about, Jeffrey, that we're doing to take Assad down a peg is all because that'll help weaken Iran's influence. That was the whole reason for intervening on the side of the Mujahideen against Assad back in 2011. So, well, and even before that. So, anyway, maybe we could stop helping the Islamic State in their war against Assad once we get a nuclear deal with Iran, huh? Hey, there's a question for Gareth. I don't know. You can see the difficulty, right, of running American foreign policy. Geez, should we back the Badr Brigade? Or should we back the Islamic State? Those are our choices, really? Huh. Maybe we could just call this off. Maybe, should we back Osama? Should we back Saddam? Should we back the Shah or the Ayatollah? You know, when the Ayatollah first came to power, the CIA and the State Department said, yeah, no, we can do business with this guy. In 1979, the coup d'etat. They said, no, don't worry about it. We know Khomeini. Yeah, he helped us with the coup d'etat against Mossadegh back in 53. So we can work with him. Oops. You know, if it hadn't have been for the hostage crisis at the embassy, they might have just kept right on in their relationship with the Ayatollah. I mean, he would have been much more independent than the Shah, but they may not have turned him into an entire enemy. That hadn't been for the riot at the embassy. But yeah, there's a great article. I can't remember who wrote it anymore, but... Well, let me see if I can find it for you. I know it's at antiwar.com. So if we say 1979, State, CIA, Iran... Oh, I'm going to spell Khomeini wrong. Search site... Yeah, here it is. Islamic Revolution had Western blessing. It's Ruzbeh. Oh, boy. Mir Brahimi. Iran's Islamic Revolution had Western blessing from 2008. Read that. It's at antiwar.com. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. What a strange world, man. Yeah, well... I know. I could go on a lot of different tangents from there, huh? Well, how about a 2-star general in Afghanistan has been fragged in an insider attack, a green-on-blue attack. You know the way they try to always spin this. A man in an Afghan army uniform. You mean a member of the Afghan army? See, they don't outright lie to you and say a man disguised as a member of the Afghan army who actually was not. But they're trying to trick you into lying to yourself. Oh, I see. It must have been an infiltrator who dressed up as an Afghan army soldier. No, he was dressed like that because that's his uniform. And then a few questions immediately come to mind. Such as, did this guy work for the Taliban? Was he actually sent somehow as some kind of long-term sleeper until he got the chance to pull off such a stunt? Or, what I think is much more likely and much more harmful narrative to the Empire, is this actually what every Afghan soldier's thinking when he sees an American 2-star general? And all of them are basically just looking for their chance, or many of them are. This is a big deal, man. New York Times, a gunman dressed as an Afghan soldier killed a United States Army Major General and wounded a German Brigadier General and at least 14 other foreign and Afghan military service members on Tuesday at a military training academy on the outskirts of Kabul. Officials of the American-led coalition said on Tuesday. The Major General appeared to be the highest-ranking member of the American military to die in hostilities since the Vietnam War. The coalition officials, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said a senior Afghan commander was also among the wounded. The official declined to identify any of the victims by name. The identity of the gunman was not disclosed either. The German military confirmed that one of its brigadier generals serving in Afghanistan was among 15 coalition-led troops wounded in the shooting, described as presumably an internal attack. The general was being treated for his injuries, which were not life-threatening, the Germans said in a statement. Other details of the shooting were sketchy, and the coalition, in an official statement, would only confirm that one of its service members had been killed in what it described as an incident at the Marshal Fahim National Defense University in Kabul. The coalition declined to specify any further details, saying it was still working to notify the family of the deceased. Tensions at the military academy ran high in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, which took place around noon, and foreign troops appeared to be on edge, fearful of another attack. Masood Hassani, a photographer for the Associated Press, said that he arrived at the camp's gate ahead of other journalists, and just as coalition armored vehicles were pulling out of the compound. A coalition soldier manning the roof-mounted gun on one of the vehicles shouted for Mr. Hassani to get away and then fired an apparent warning shot. I don't know what he fired, but it was fired near our car, he said, adding that he left the scene straight away. Wow. So, there you go. New York Times version here. U.S. general is reportedly killed by an Afghan soldier. So, now what? Last time this happened, they say, was in 1970. A Major General Dillard Jr., Albert B. Dillard Jr., was killed when his helicopter was shot down. And a Rear Admiral, which is the Navy's equivalent, was killed in 1972 when his helicopter crashed. Yeah, I don't think that counts. Wow. So, now what? Because you got to figure, or I don't know what this sounds like, what it means to the American people. Is this just another dead somebody in Afghanistan and nobody cares anymore? Or are we all just kind of cluck our tongues and care a tiny little bit? We're all against it, but just a little. Or is this a big deal? I mean, CNN goes, oh my God, look, a major general got shot. Okay, let's talk about Ebola some more. I guess they're queuing up for the press conference on this. But what about the shockwaves inside the Pentagon and inside the White House and the National Security Council and the Senate and the head jerks? Is this sort of like, oh, what's his name, throwing the shoe at George W. Bush's head? I'm like, go ahead and just leave then. Enough of this. Because, you know, they'll throw away another 10,000 enlisted men. They don't really care about that. But a general, you know, that's like a real person. That's somebody who matters, who's supposed to get to retire early. That's a member of the club. So now they might just reinvade. Oh, yeah? You're going to kill one of our generals, huh? Well, we're going to carpet bomb the crap out of you, right? Why not? Or maybe it could go the other way. And people could just throw up their hands and say, wow, it sort of seems like most powerful military in the world and all that notwithstanding, you've failed completely to tame Afghanistan, to pacify it, to build a nation, to clear and hold and build a government in a box, to change their entire society. All those, of course, are direct quotes out of the counterinsurgency strategy nonsense of David Petraeus and all of his little suckasses have followed him around and repeated his stuff for money. But, yeah, man, so, I don't know, what do you guys think? Hey, chat room, what do you think? Gonna go ahead, alright, that's it, tail between her legs and leave? Or, maybe they're gonna double down this war now, as a matter of principle, you know? Principality's at stake here, Smokey. You guys are gonna die for that. Kill a general. I don't know. Guess we'll see. I guess... American public opinion probably doesn't really have that much to do with it, right? We don't get to choose. The question is, what's the Pentagon going to do about this? What's Barack Obama going to do about this? I think, you know, the best thing that we have going is he is the biggest wimp, the biggest loser ever to be the president. And due to his cowardice, thank goodness, he has kept us out of some of the worst things that he could have done. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm his worst enemy and all that, and he's certainly done his regime changes and committed his acts of treason and all that, but boy, compare him to what McCain would have had him do? Yeah. Let's all hope and pray that tiny, pathetic little boy Obama will be too afraid to take some kind of serious revenge. Best chance we have of winding this thing down, I think. Alright, guys. Hang tight. Back in a minute. ScottHorton.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Oh my, I'm so scared of Ebola. Please don't give it to me, CNN. Please don't give me the Ebola. Here's not scaring me at all, sorry. Hey, they're saying this magic potion, the secret serum. Why are they calling it a secret serum? Come on, you invented some kind of medicine or something, right? Why don't you call it that? We invented some kind of medicine. This seems to be helping this one guy a little. Okay. Everything's got to have a brand name. Ebola Secret Serum. All right. Well, anyway. I prefer that they cover crap, honestly. If they're covering Ukraine, if they're covering Iran, if they're covering Iraq, formerly known as Iraq, if they're covering Gaza, it's going to be worse, more horrible, right? They're going to be helping propagate untruths toward the further maiming and killing of people, so just go ahead and scare me with your damn Ebola some more, instead of telling me how necessary it is that we stay in Afghanistan longer. Sorry. All right. So much going on. 1,900-something dead in Palestine. I'm sorry, I don't know the exact numbers. There's a 72-hour ceasefire that last I heard is holding. At the same time, though, Netanyahu is vowing a prolonged campaign. I mentioned to you yesterday the article by Patrick Coburn. I should try to get Patrick on today. But he had a thing about Israel and, well, what are they winning at this point? In fact, you know, Angela Keaton sent me an email the other day saying, how long is this going to go on? So I wondered to myself, hey, that's a pretty damn good question. Well, let me think about it. I think they've accomplished as much as they actually can accomplish. Considering they don't, they could, if it really came down to it, they could completely destroy Hamas, hunt down every last fighting age male and crucify him or whatever the hell, but, you know, politically, that's pretty difficult, and they're afraid that Islamic State types or Al-Qaeda types would end up taking Hamas's place. So they don't really want to completely get rid of Hamas. They want to punish them, so kill a lot of them, and a lot of whoever else happens to be around, or whoever happens to be down the block, or whoever happens to live in the village next door to the one where a Hamas guy was one time, or, you know, kill whoever they feel like in the name of hunting Hamas, or, you know, all that. For a while, they've destroyed some rockets, presumably, and they've given Hamas an opportunity to go ahead and deplete their stock down to whatever percent. So you could call that some kind of tactical victory on the part of the Israelis. Again, it would take an absolute full-scale campaign to get rid of every last rocket, and even then, you'd never get rid of every last one of them, right? It's still, we're just talking about plumbing pipe and homemade propellant, so a lot of times not even with an explosive warhead on it. Anyway, a lot of times they just blow up. They don't even get hit by the Iron Dome. They just explode in the sky because they're garage-made pieces of garbage, right? Anyway, and then so they decide, well, tunnels, that's part of what is their agenda here. We got to go after the tunnels. But they can't find and destroy every last tunnel. And most of those, as they know, are for going to Egypt, going to Sinai, and trading with people so that they can not all starve to death rather than being terror tunnels. And apparently, as Coburn repeats, there's a story going around in the Israeli media. You know, I could imagine it's probably the same thing on most right-wing talk radio. I don't know if it is, but it's the kind of thing they would fall for. There was going to be some kind of massive, you know, Tet Offensive type thing, where if it wasn't for the IDF saving us, Hamas was going to send every last armed guy they have through these tunnels, and they're going to infiltrate deep into Israeli territory and just massacre everyone and all this. This is completely ridiculous. Most of the tunnels hardly go past the wall at all. Even go that direction at all. Again, most of them go to Egypt for trade. They're trading tunnels, not terror tunnels. And then even the ones going toward Israel were, so far, no one has proven any of them to be for anything but military purposes, going just outside the wall for attacking Israeli troops. But the idea that there was going to be some, you know, massive offensive through these tunnels and some mass slaughter of Israelis and, you know, inside 48 borders Israel and all this is ridiculous. Just look, you know, they can rumor about what was going to happen all they want, but look at the numbers. It's virtually, what, 95% or more of the Israeli casualties are combatants, are IDF soldiers in Gaza. There was one civilian who was, or a couple of civilians who were feeding them, who were killed not by rockets, but by artillery. But, you know, doing the Molly Pitcher thing for them or whatever, they were casualties. So they're not really combatants, but you could actually count that as collateral damage. They weren't innocent civilians sitting in their home like so many dead Gazans in this thing. But then the numbers are nearly 2,000 dead Gazans. And according to the United Nations, 80% of them civilians. More than 300 dead kids. That's more than dead Hamas fighters. And I know the Israelis' numbers are different, but not much different. They say, nuh-uh, you know, hey, almost half of the people that we've killed have been combatants. Oh, almost half, huh? The rest of them being innocent people. Oh, okay. What? I mean, talk about tone deaf. These Osbrists really ought to just stay home. They're better off being silent than making these ridiculous arguments that they make. Yes, we've killed hundreds of kids, but so? Well, actually, most humans object to that kind of thing. Israeli government, take note. Call Frank Luntz and ask him to do a focus group and poll whether we like it or not when you blow up little kids to death for no reason. Even, you know, let him specify that they are brown, and so, you know, for whatever reason, you know, their language is really hard to understand for an American. How about that? Make sure to emphasize that. Gazans don't wear funny hats, though, really. You ever notice that? They dress like Westerners. They really need his brand names. They are always wearing very off-brand, like old Izod and this kind of thing. That what they need is sports jerseys, American sports teams, and they need the logos of all the latest thing. You know, I don't know what all is the latest thing now, but that's what they need on their clothes even more. But if you ever see pictures of Gaza, they don't often show pictures of Gaza other than the occasional crater on TV. But I don't know. They look pretty human to me. I know that, you know, Frank Luntz can have a lot of great success spinning it otherwise for a focus group. But, I don't know. To me, and I shouldn't speak for everybody else because I don't represent everybody else. But it does occur to me that a lot of the Israeli spin about the civilians that they kill is laughable and ridiculous and, of course, then completely contemptible. Since it's supposed to serve as the excuse for killing people. Yeah. I don't know. Hey, they were nearby where a rocket took off. I don't know, guys. Yeah, anyway. Supposedly it's a ceasefire now. Oh, and I guess one more thing. Where's the music? Oh, no, I'm still early. I thought I heard the beat, and then I didn't know what happened. I guess I was hallucinating. Oh, there it goes. Well, I'll just say this real quick because I don't want to spend a bunch of time on it. Some Hamas guy said some stupid thing about Christian blood and the matzahs and some blood libel. And CNN is now just playing that over and over and over and over again, trying to sabotage the peace deal. And it seems as though the quote is actually even taken out of context, that he's paraphrasing someone else. But regardless, name-calling versus actual killing on CNN all day today. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Check out this headline. Police pepper spray, quote, larger than normal 6-year-old. That's a great excuse, guys. You know, you totally won me over with that. No, this was a really big 6-year-old, though, argument. Holy crap. All right. Well, you see, here's the thing about America. There's no accountability for government employees who break the law. None. Ever. And so, if there's no accountability, then there's no rules. They can do anything they want. It's up only to them at the time. And all any of the other government employees will do is close ranks around them and protect them from consequences for any of their actions. They could break into your house right now and kill you and your little sister. And then go outside and go, yeah, so? And all the judges and all the cops and all the DAs and all the local TV news people will repeat, yeah, so? They can kill people if they want to. And then that's it. No accountability means no rules. And so if you're a cop and you would like to attack a six-year-old boy with a chemical weapon, then you do that. The boy weighs approximately 100 pounds. Wow, he's a pretty fat six-year-old, it sounds like then, huh? Oh, but he had a knife. What was the cop supposed to do? The six-year-old had a knife. The cop had no choice other than, of course, pepper spray, taser, or bullet to the brain. I guess we should be happy that out of the three, the cop settled for pepper spraying the six-year-old child in the face. He was a really big six-year-old, guys. He was coming at me. Oh, man. Hey, at least he didn't kill him. He could have, though. He could have blown that kid's head off and said, he was a really big six-year-old, guys. And that would have been it. The grand jury would have sent a no bill. That's assuming that the DA would have even brought on the case. If he had, of course, he would have said, well, ladies and gentlemen of the grand jury, you need to recognize that this was a really big six-year-old. I mean, before the cop blew his head off, he was really tall for his age and weighed nearly 100 pounds. So you could see why the officer had to blow his head off. And the grand jury would say, yeah, we all agree with that. That's the consensus, isn't it, guys? Yeah, okay, no bill. There is no law that governs what police or any government employees may do to any of us. So, of course, you know, the cop attacked the six-year-old. Kid had a knife. I'm so scared. Aren't you scared of the six-year-old with a knife? Oh, good. They already got a hashtag six-year-old with a knife going on in the chat room here. Amazing. All right. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. You want to join up the chat room and hang out with the guys? Just go to scotthorton.org/chat. scotthorton.org/chat. And I try not to do this much. You know, I never have like a week of fundraising or anything like that. But count this as like a mini fund drive. I will mention that there is such a URL as scotthorton.org/donate. And actually, if you're there, what would be most important for you to do would be to follow the instructions how to contact me, how to advertise on the show. I'd rather try, at least, to give you something for your money, other than just the show that I'm doing anyway, although that's pretty good, too. So, all right, scotthorton.org/donate. That is a thing. Believe it. Okay. Now, there's so much different stuff to talk about. I want to spend a lot of time on Islamic State today. I don't have any guests on it for you, but I got a lot of news to cover. The nation formerly known as Iraq, its partner across the former border, Syria, and what's going on with all of that. Lots to talk about there. But I guess, and I have a couple of invites out too, so there may be some more interviews. Did I mention recently Phil Giraldi and Gareth Porter will both be here? I know they're both favorites of y'all's and mine, so good. So you'll have to stick around because Giraldi and Porter. But here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about this yesterday, and I didn't get a chance. But it's my idea that it... Maybe it's too late now, I don't know. I won't argue whether it's too late now. I will argue that it seems to me that in the recent past, even, if the Israelis, going back to, say, I don't know, mid-90s, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, if he had lived and if he had given up the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip and let them have a Palestinian state, and if he could have got the Israeli population behind that, that really was the best solution. And if they had tried to, you know, even if they got to build up their military dominance of the region or whatever, if they had still only held that really in a real, real peace through strength kind of attitude, but kept it all in the background. I mean, they got nukes and everything. They have since the 60s. Everybody knows that. So, but still had an attitude of trying to have peace and friendship and get along with the Palestinian nation, get along with Jordan, get along with the Syrians as best they can, normal diplomatic relations. You know, 1948 was a long time ago. And, you know, as I endlessly repeat on this show, all the different Arab authorities over the years have been willing to recognize Israel within 67 borders to one degree or another. It's certainly open to negotiation, if the Israelis negotiate in good faith. And I believe I could be wrong. And you can't prove me wrong because it's a counterfactual, metaphysical, just sort of an idea kind of a thing anyway. But I think that if the Israelis had decided that instead of being Ariel Sharon, they wanted to be Yitzhak Rabin, if instead of being Benjamin Netanyahu, they wanted to have not a clean break, they wanted Oslo. They wanted to give up the West Bank and let the Palestinians have at least what's left of their homeland within 67 lines, then I think things could be okay. I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous discussion even. I mean, basically the choices are you could do like the United States did and completely eradicate the Indians almost entirely, and just completely take it all from them. Or you can go ahead and at some point be a good sport and lighten up and shake hands. You can't just keep occupying and dominating and ruling under totalitarian martial law this population of Palestinian, you know, homebound exiles in their own land like this. And you can't expect, Israel can't expect to have a normal relationship with any of their neighbors as long as the occupation continues. If the theory here is that, you know, all these arrangements are temporary, you know, then the modern nation state is really only since the 1600s and that kind of thing. So things certainly change over eons. But if the plan basically is in every country that they would like their more or less system the way it is now to last, their country to last, never mind their you know, fourth republic or fifth one or any of that kind of crap, but I just mean they want their country to last for hundreds of years into the future, then having an attitude of, we are the worst of all of your enemies, everyone, forever, is not tenable. It's just not tenable. I mean, they can have all the H-bombs that they want, but at some point, at the rate they're going, they're going to have to actually use them. And then what? How does anybody think that this slow-motion Greater Israel policy actually makes sense for the future of Israel? If you listen to their defense minister, oh no, their former defense minister, Barak is out now. But if you listen to Ehud Barak, who was the former prime minister from the late 90s and was Netanyahu's defense minister up until a couple of years ago, and Ehud Olmert, the previous prime minister before the current one, Netanyahu, they say that, hey, listen, we're on a fast train toward an apartheid state of minority rule, which will be untenable. And when we have to choose between democracy or a Jewish state, we'll have to choose democracy, because international politics, and then we'll lose our Jewish state that we want so bad. So that's, you know, from the horse's mouth. They're on a suicidal policy, and yet they persist. And it doesn't have to be this way.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. New Scahill out at The Intercept, Barack Obama's secret terrorist tracking system by the numbers. Related here at Wired, visit the wrong website and the FBI could end up in your computer. It's by Kevin Paulson about FBI malware. Again, it's just like with all this stuff, it amounts to a general warrant to scoop up all kinds of things, looking for crimes, looking for the guilty instead of investigating crimes. He compares it to a drift net rather than a single fishing line, but even a single fishing line is actually supposed to be beyond the pale in America. There you go. More on your high-tech slavery there. And I see Scahill has just tweeted out that they try to undermine the story by leaking it to others. I don't know if anybody else picked it up first or not. You know, got their version out or not. But anyway. All right. So, you know, yeah, I'm going to save the Al-Qaeda thing. I got a lot of Islamic State, this and that I want to talk about, but there's so much other stuff too. And so I want to put that off for a minute. Again, Giraldi and Porter coming up on Palestine and Iran. There's the Cuba thing. I honestly didn't even read about this, but I just heard of it, and I'm sure you guys did. But just in case you didn't, there was some massive U.S. aid project that AP has busted. Remember they had their little fake Cuban Twitter they were trying to create? Well, it was a larger plan for regime change in Cuba. The U.S. Agency for International Development, that's really just a spinoff of the CIA in the regime change business. It's semi-covert, secret, illegal activity, and then, but, you know, on its face, it's just non-governmental organizations trying to help you. And part of this was even a HIV prevention workshop. Isn't that just like government? They have no concern for collateral damage whatsoever. Now, you know, in Cuba, I don't know if they'll really have this much of a problem, but you never really know what the blowback could be. But look at what they did when they were trying to verify their assumption, their conclusion, that Osama bin Laden was hiding out in Abbottabad. They ran this bogus inoculation campaign. Oh yeah, no, we're here just to protect you from polio. But actually they were looking for bin Laden DNA. Well, they never got any. They went and did this to the whole neighborhood just so they could try to get away with getting samples from the people in that house, but they were refused at the gate. They never got any DNA anyway. But all they did was, and you guys know this, right? This is a huge thing. Well, over there it's huge. All they did was just solidify the Taliban and every right-wing religious nut's opposition to polio vaccinations in Pakistan. And has even led to severe violence and I think even the murder of some you know, aid workers, legitimate aid workers who are just trying to protect children from polio. And now they're all accused of being CIA. They're all tainted forever with that covert operation, which failed, which had nothing to do with the eventual raid, etc., etc. But they don't care. What do they care about a bunch of Pakistani kids getting polio? Because they spread rumors that every vaccination campaign is actually the boogeyman trying to poison you and your child. They don't care. What do they care? They don't at all. Same thing here. If this, you know, leads to a rolling back of AIDS education and prevention efforts in Cuba and more people die of AIDS, whatever. Anyway, don't you know they're trying to get rid of the Castro brothers? Same story since 1949. Was it 59? No, it was 59. I was thinking of Mao. But still. Anyway. Their efforts were fraught with incompetence and risk. An Associated Press investigation found Cuban authorities questioned who was bankrolling the travelers. The young workers nearly blew their mission to identify potential social change actors. One said he got a paltry 30-minute seminar on how to evade Cuban intelligence, and there appeared to be no safety net for the inexperienced workers if they were caught. Yeah, that's a good part about, having the CIA subsidize this kind of stuff to the USAID, is they end up just sending, like, these Peace Corps kids to go and get nabbed. We value your safety, one senior USAID official said in an email. The guidance applies to all travelers to the island, not just American citizens. The revelations of the USAID program come as the White House faces questions about the once-secret Cuban Twitter known as Zunzunio. That program, launched by USAID in 2009 and covered by the AP in April, established a primitive social media network under the noses of Cuban officials. USAID's Inspector General is investigating that program, which ended in 2012. Yeah, anyway, so they'll never stop messing around. Point is, again, about the HIV thing. Nice cover to use. Yeah, these people who are here to teach you about how to not get AIDS, actually can't trust them. They're probably CIA. Oh, great. Thanks a lot, American government. You really suck. All right. Skipping around here. In Pakistan, a new report has come out about the drone war there. Nearly half of the drone strike victims, they say, 323 out of a little over 700 are reported to be civilians, including 99 children. I'm surprised it's not worse than that. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism's Naming the Dead project, which was launched last year, has now recorded the names of more than 700 of the 2,342 people reportedly killed by CIA drones in Pakistan. That project was originally run by a guy named Chris Woods, who we've talked to on the show many times, who I think has left for greener pastures writing somewhere else, but it's good to see that the Bureau has continued with that reporting there. And, you know, whatever, drone strikes, polio. They may or may not be near enemies of the U.S. government, so they don't have a right to live anymore. That's how it works. That's called international law. It's the same law that says the cops can kill you if they want and never, ever, ever be held accountable. Foreigners flee Libya, 22 killed in battle for Tripoli airport. This is from the 3rd. Nations scramble to evacuate stranded citizens amid growing war. Nations across the world are scrambling to get the last of their citizens out of Libya while the getting is good. As a nascent civil war continues to escalate, the battle centering on major cities like Tripoli and Benghazi. Today, the fighting again was over control of the Tripoli airport, where different militias battled to control the important hub and nearby business district. At least 22 were killed and scores of others wounded. That may be just the tip of the iceberg as the fuel depot in the area continues to burn and the oil ministry expresses concern that explosions could add to the death toll. A lot of Western nations have already completed their evacuations, with Britain sending a Royal Navy ship to take the last 100 citizens out of Tripoli today. Egypt, meanwhile, is airlifting some 1,800 of their citizens out of the region as they fled to nearby Tunisia. Jesus. You know, I don't know, man. At least they're not invading. I guess, you know, they prefer chaos to Gaddafi, who was half-friendly to the Europeans and the Americans. Come on. I know, John McCain tried to sell him a bunch of armored personnel carriers for his death squads, and he wouldn't buy them like he promised. That's no reason really to do a regime change, is it? And now it's just chaos there. You could say Ansar al-Sharia and CIA Haftar, wannabe al-Sisi, are the two major players, but there are more than 1,000 militias there. It's going to be war for years still in Libya now.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These PNAC clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page.
Hey guys, welcome back. I'm me, this is my show. Hey, so you guys have seen those clips of the son of the founder of Hamas going around and criticizing Hamas, all the right wingers pass him around. Turns out he was a spy for Israel for a decade.
Really?
Huh. That's interesting. He looks like the jerk and the son of a jerk. He looks like a kind of a douche. When the son of Hamas spied for Israel, is this article at the Daily Beast. That's interesting. I only got to read about four or five paragraphs, and then the damn music started playing again. But check Jeff Stein's Twitter. You follow Spy Talk. Jeff Stein, great journalist on Twitter, just tweeted out. So again, the Daily Beast. All right. There's so much to talk about. Oh, I want to talk about the cops. Did you see this? Boston rolls out police state to search for carjackers? This is at the Liberty Crier. They do such a great job of covering local police abuse stories over there. Trevor Lyman and the Liberty Crier. You should sign up for their morning email, too. It's great. And anyway, so they just brought out full SWAT gear, locked down all the roads, and then, no, it was worse than that. Wait a minute. They had some kind of damn shelter-in-place sort of damn thing. Residents were placed on lockdown and told to remain indoors during the door-to-door search conducted by law enforcement. And I believe they don't even know who they're looking for. They're just wandering around in full SWAT gear going to everyone's house. This is insane. And of course they're carrying M4s or M16s or maybe they're AR-15s. I guess I can't tell just by looking at them. But anyway, if you own that kind of rifle, it's an assault rifle. So it's an assault rifle when they're carrying it too. Semi or full automatic. Apparently makes no difference. Police unable to locate two men wanted in alleged carjacking. It was a frightening scene in Melrose, Massachusetts, as SWAT teams went door-to-door searching for two men who carjacked a 14-year-old boy. What is the 14-year-old boy? Oh, he's sitting in the passenger seat of his mom's car at the shopping plaza while she went to the store when all of a sudden two suspects got in the car and sped off. This dude is probably going 80 miles an hour down the highway. Yeah. Anyway, so the guys got away. Police don't believe the suspects ever had a firearm. As for the motive for the carjacking, they believe the suspect skipped out on a cab the night before. And maybe had stolen. Yeah, I don't know. So, cool. The lockdown isn't even the news story, according to the local news. And then, did you guys hear this one? Police state revenge. The man who shot the NYC choke video held on gun charge. Again, at the Liberty Crier from the Associated Press. The guy who shot the footage of the NYPD choking the man to death over an accusation, supposing they knew better at the time, that he was selling cigarettes without paying his taxes. And murdered him. Medical examiner says it was a homicide. Well, video says it was the cop murdered him. The man said, amazingly, was able to get out. I can't breathe. It's on camera. It's on video. The phone picked it up. He said that somewhere between 9 and 15 times. And then died. And then when the EMS showed up, They took the side of the cops that, oh, you guys murdered somebody, huh? Cool. And they just let him sit there, lay there, and die all the way and didn't do anything to try to resuscitate him whatsoever. Guilty murderers. Well, so according to the man's family, they set him up. They're accusing him of being in possession of a firearm, which he's not allowed to do from prior felonies. Or at least he's accused of on felony charges. I don't know. Assault charge, robbery charges. I don't see convictions here. So, according to his family, he was set up. Of course, the police are guilty until proven innocent beyond a shadow of a doubt. So his family's story holds up. They set him up. They're taking revenge on the guy who proved they're guilty of murder, as though they'll be charged or convicted of anything. Give us all a break. But they're going to go ahead and get revenge against this guy anyway. And here's what's funny about this. Plain and simple injustice. Anybody who's seen the video of what happened to this guy, that this guy shot, knows who's innocent, who's guilty, what happened there. You would have to be a hardcore right-wing, pro-police ideologue to take the side of the police. Any other decent human on earth is on the side of the innocent victim who got choked to death by the cop who murdered him. But so, right-wingers, I guess, would be the ones who would take the side of the cops, if anybody. Right? And of course, for liberals, anytime anyone can be prosecuted on a gun charge, they're for that. So really, there shouldn't be a problem here, considering libertarians apparently don't exist, and we live in a world of liberals, or a country at least, of liberals and conservatives. The consensus here is, hey, don't you film the police when they're murdering people. You should respect their authority to murder whoever they want, and you should not try to get them in trouble by filming them murder people and linking it to the news. So you get what you deserve. That's the Republican position. And then the liberal position is, you're not allowed to have a gun. Because not allowed. Right? No one's accusing the man who filmed this video of using a gun against anybody. Just, there's a prohibition on him having the gun, and he violated the prohibition. So all liberals either now have to renounce their support for gun control, or they have to go ahead and admit that they're on the side of the cops who are using a lousy gun charge against the guy who filmed them murdering the innocent guy that they murdered. Or you have to all just become libertarians and realize that cops are evil murderers, and they're the ones who should have their guns taken away. They are the most violent and disruptive force in our society, rather than any kind of solution to violence and disruption in our society. Get it straight. Same thing, you hear me, every time I interview somebody from the ACLU, I try to tell them, man, you guys have got to get good on guns. You know, next to pot and cocaine charges, what do you think black people are going to jail for, where it's, you know, victimless crimes, charges where they're not really doing anything other than committing an offense against state edicts? It's gun charges. Gun prohibition. And yet in America, we got the right to own guns, just like we got the right to drink alcohol and all that kind of thing, too. It's the same kind of thing. And it doesn't work any better than alcohol or drug prohibition either, gun prohibition. Just destroys lives effectively. Sure doesn't keep guns out of the hands of criminals.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Bovard's got a great piece out in the Washington Times about Bill Clinton's good friends in the Kosovo Liberation Army, who are just an adjunct to bin Laden's Mujahideen-type movement, basically. Although, thankfully, they kind of grew old and didn't turn out to be as bad as they could have, but still, they've been horrible if you're a Serb, that's for sure. But anyway, oh yeah, so they're the worst kind of gangsters, if not, you know, bin Ladenite, jihadist, expansionist, suicide bomber types. And Bovard's got a great piece in the Washington Times about them kidnapping people and killing them and selling their organs. And how a European task force has finally confirmed with their final report here that the KLA had engaged in, quote, unlawful killings, abductions, and forced disappearances, illegal detention camps in Kosovo and Albania, sexual violence, forced displacements of individuals from their homes and communities, and desecration and destruction of churches and other religious sites. And he goes on to remind us that there was no genocide. Bill Clinton lied and said 100,000 men, women, and children had been slaughtered by the Serbs of Albanian Muslims in Kosovo. It was an outright lie. All the FBI went afterwards to prove it was true, and all they could find was a few thousand bodies, and they were all fighting-age males, presumably fighters. And all the worst of whatever ethnic cleansing happened after the bombing campaign started. The Serbs then took the opportunity to try to do some cleansing, which, of course, ended up backfiring anyway. But anyway, whole thing is absolute disaster, and I'll never forget Clinton declaring that war on TV. And I'll never forget how it was supposed to last a couple of days, and instead it lasted for 6 weeks and killed a couple of thousand people and maimed and wounded many more. And they admitted at the time that part of what they were doing was trying to suck up to Islamists who hate America by showing that, no, we'll see, look, we're taking your side. Yeah, what great propaganda. I guess they're all just going to forget about Palestine now, huh? They're all just going to forget about your no-fly zone bombing and blockade of Iraq now, huh? Democrats. They're disgusting. That's James Bovard. When the spoils of war are human organs. Human organs. At the Washington Times, WashingtonTimes.com. Crying out loud. And then here's the other thing. I swear I'm going to get to the Islamic State stuff here in a minute. But a friend emailed to say that someone that he knew had never really heard of the military-industrial complex before, had never come across that term, and was actually quite surprised to find out what it meant. Like, you know, understood. But still just was kind of like, wow, my mind is blown. I didn't really, you know, understand that things worked that way at all. You know, not just that it didn't have a name, but that, you know, that that's how it is. And so I thought, you know, I would just try to explain it in the simplest sense because it is very simple. The military-industrial complex, it's the same for all of the very biggest industries in America. You've got this public democracy that supposedly belongs to everybody. But, of course, everybody's just an individual, and all their interests ultimately are private ones. And so you have all of the biggest industries, starting with Hamilton and the bankers, all the way back at the foundation of the Constitution. The banks, and then, of course, the industrialists, especially the military-industrial complex, and those who, you know, the things they manufacture are for sale exclusively to the military or other countries' militaries. And then, of course, there's agribusiness and there's big medicine. Oh, the insurance companies, they go along there with the banks. Banks, insurance companies, military-industrial complex, agribusiness, old people, which that's really the medical lobby again, the AARP. And, of course, there's Israel. And who am I leaving out? These are the conspirators in the secret society that rules America. It's called the U.S. Congress. These are the people who come together to hold a gun to the head of all of the other 300 million of us to take our stuff to give it to their friends. That's really what the Congress is. The Congress is not made up of, you know, elected representatives of the people at all. They're the front men for the vested interests. When I was, a freshman in high school or somewhere around there, maybe I was still in junior high, Ross Perot ran for president. And he was such a ridiculous character. And I knew early on, someone had told me that the reason he was a billionaire is because he did business with the government all along. He was not a free market guy. He was on the dole himself his whole career. But anyway, he would go on and on about the special interests, the special interests. And I never understood what that was supposed to mean. But that's what it means, is that anybody rich enough to buy a few congressmen, they do so. And if they're really freaking good at it, they devote a certain part of their budget to exclusively doing everything they can to lobby Congress to get what they want. It's the economics of politics. And so for when I say really good at it, look, for example, at Lockheed Martin, Marietta, McDonnell, whatever the hell now. Okay, what Lockheed does is they make sure that every project that they have going, every fighter plane or every bomber, whatever it is that they make, that some part of it is made in as many congressional districts in the nation as possible. In some cases, all of them. So that if any congressman wants to turn against the project, they can go on a campaign that this congressman is trying to destroy jobs in this community so that no congressman will dare. So that they'll always have approval for the parochial, self-interest, individual, private interests of the individual congressman. That if they want to keep being a congressman, they want to keep eating steaks and, you know, doing cocaine off of nice-looking girls and all the wonderful things that come with being a congressman, then they better go ahead and vote for what Lockheed wants. And that's the same thing for Archer Daniels Midland and Monsanto in agribusiness. It's the same thing, of course, for J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Chase, Goldman, blah, 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 up there on Wall Street and the rest of them. And in fact, what's fun is you'll see a story from time to time. Oh my God, it's a record. Lockheed spends a Guinness Book of World Records book making $14 million on lobbying Congress in the first half of 2012 or whatever. $14 million? Psh, that's nothing. $14 million is nothing compared to what the congressman lobbied to give back to Lockheed. It's the best investment in the history of the world. No doubt about it. And you can't even really argue that, yeah, but Lockheed does have to come up with the weapons because a lot of times, actually, yeah, no, they just get the money. I mean, look at the F-35. It was the most ridiculous project really probably ever in American military history. The biggest waste ever, ever, ever. And it doesn't matter. The designer of the F-15 and the F-16 was, I played the audio of him on the show telling the interviewer, its purpose, really, its primary purpose is to transfer money from the Treasury to Lockheed, to its, you know, executive vice presidents and board of directors and shareholders. That's the purpose of the plane. It can't dogfight. It's not that fast. It's not stealthy. It doesn't carry much firepower because it's pretending it's stealthy. And so it has to carry all its bombs on the inside. And it's a complete piece of crap. And sometimes the engine explodes and you can't fly it in the rain or near lightning. And you think I'm making this up. But the F-35 is an absolute and total complete piece of crap. And you could buy 10 F-14s or 15s or 16s. Well, I guess they retired the 14. But you could buy 10 15s or 16s for the price of one of these ridiculous F-35s. But that doesn't matter. That has actually nothing to do with it. What it has everything to do with is how expensive can we make it? How can we transfer the most amount of money out of the hands of the American people who work for it all day to the people who are already richest and most evil and corrupt on the planet? Simple as that. There's your conspiracy. It's called Congress. And its evil satanic charter is the Constitution. And they are at war against us. And simple as that. Oh, and they're at war with the rest of the world, too. You might have noticed. All right, next, paranoid ranting about the Islamic State.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, yeah, I got Gareth's piece read, so I'll be ready to interview him, hopefully, then. That's pretty good. Gareth Porter and Phil Giraldi both coming up on the show today. Yeah, I know. You could call it the Gareth Porter and Phil Giraldi show. It's pretty close to that, isn't it? But that's fine by me, so good. All right, listen, so I got a ton of stories out of the Islamic State going on here. And I caught that because it seems like it is that, really. I mean, I always thought it was funny they called themselves the Islamic State before, back in 2007, or whatever, 2006 and 7. You guys aren't the Islamic State. You guys are tolerated by the Sunni tribes. You're not the boss of them. They're still part of Iraq, and you guys are the sidekicks. But I think that really has changed, at least to a great degree. Although, you know, I don't know. And really, I'm sorry, I forgot. I spaced this out. I should have started the show with this. U.S. to give Kurdish forces air support. This is at Rudaw, RUDAW.net, which is a Kurdish paper. And I talked with Eric Garris, and he says he has a lot of experience with their reporting and that it always holds up. And here's why I believe this. Because Mitchell Prothero already reported on this story that the CIA and the Special Forces were rebuilding, were building up a former base there in Kurdistan. That's already going on, and we've known about it for a few weeks now. And we talked with the reporter who reported it right here on the show. And then, of course, also Maliki has said he's going to provide air cover for the Kurds. Well, what the hell air cover does he have to provide for the Kurds? Oh, I see. You want to pretend when the Americans are flying air cover in a few days that that's you doing it. Oh, okay. Seems like to me. And also, look at it like this. The Americans are feeling like they got to do something, but they don't have anybody to back in Iraq except for the Kurds. They can't rely on Maliki. And they don't want to be seen as standing side by side with the Iranians, which, where's my Iran story here? I think it's this one. Nope. Yes, this one here. All right, get to that in a second. They don't want to be seen as fighting with the Iranians, even if it's against ISIS. You know, Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, they always did want to stay in Kurdistan anyway. But the problem with that is the Kurds have made friends with Erdogan in Turkey, surprisingly. But that really doesn't answer the question of what about the Turkish Kurds if they really do declare a sovereign and independent Kurdish state. And what about the fact that they're still landlocked and surrounded by an Iran that doesn't want to let their Kurdish population break off a piece of their state? And I guess, you know, the Kurds in Syria talk about between a rock and a hard place with the Islamic State ruling all of eastern Syria now, or for now. I don't know what about what they're going to do. But anyway, so this is the story, U.S. to give Kurdish forces air support, and it is still future tense here, but it sounds pretty plausible to me. Rudaw, has learned from a high-level American official that the United States has offered the Kurds air support in their fight against the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. An official source who didn't want to be named said the U.S. would also provide the Kurdish Peshmerga with arms and military expertise. The American offer is said to include humanitarian aid and be transported by air to the people of Shangal and Zumar, who have been displaced as a result of fighting in their areas. So there you have it. America's reinvading Iraq. At least for now, just in Kurdistan. And then this story is in Reuters, and it's reported in part by Ned Parker, our old friend from the Los Angeles Times, who, you know, he's pretty conventional in his thinking, but I think he does pretty good journalism sometimes. I remember talking with him and him actually knowing what the hell he was talking about, which is nice, compared to a lot of reporting by, you know, Western reporters out of situations like what's going on in Iraq. And anyway, this is about the extensive presence of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces and their some of their highest officers in trying to organize the Shiite resistance to the rise of the new Islamic State. And, of course, you know, the terrorizing of the Sunnis who were left in Shiite-controlled Baghdad. Qasem Soleimani, the head of external operations of the Revolutionary Guards, known as the Quds Force, recently traveled to Baghdad, according to reports from a number of Iranian news sites. An Iraqi parliamentarian posted a picture on the internet of himself with Soleimani in Iraq in mid-June. And anyway, so this is just going to make matters worse and worse here. I tried to tell y'all back before the war. I know y'all means whoever could hear, you know, pirate radio in South Austin at the time and whatever. But still, I said, you know, you do this, the consequences are going to reverberate for decades and decades. And even from the time of the rise of the Badr Brigades and the El Salvador option, it was clear that, man, the consequences from this are going to just keep playing out and playing out. And, so major Iranian intervention. Again, America and Iran were on the same side in the last Iraq war. And, the relationship between the Kurds and the Shiites, has kind of cooled off, but maybe they have enough in common in their enemy in the Islamic State still. There are other major developments. Islamic State threatens major Iraqi dam, takes fight into Lebanon. That's Mitchell Prothero at McClatchy. Also, Kurds mustering to fend off Islamic State advance in northern Iraq. And, of course, you know, they're still fighting for the dam. They don't have control of the dams, but that sure gives away their plan is that they're perfectly happy to use control of the Tigris and Euphrates to wage war against the Shiites downriver. And, you know, Maliki's forces don't have the ability to do a damn thing about it. I don't think so over the long term. If that's the way the Islamic State guys want to play it. Also, there are reports that they're tunneling around down south of Baghdad and preparing for a long-term siege of Baghdad. They can't take Baghdad, which is an 85% Shiite city now, and it's militias. But they can suicide bomb it, and as Prothero was talking about on the show, they have seized all these artillery pieces, man, like many, many, many of them, and they got a range of tens of miles anyway, 30, 40 miles, and they can just shell Baghdad for years if they want. They're armed to the teeth. Now, I did read a thing that was saying that it's disputed that they ever really robbed the Bank of Mosul and seized $500 million and all that. Made me want to go back and look at that. Apparently, the Financial Times, which hides its everything behind a paywall, was saying that that was in dispute. But anyway, they've got tons of equipment. And never mind the Blackhawks. That's just symbolic. They don't have the expertise or the material for the maintenance or anything like that to really use Black Hawk helicopters in war. They have seized them in order just to give America the middle finger anyway, at least. But they sure as hell can use those tanks and those trucks and those artillery pieces they've got their hands on. And then now, as I just read in that Prothero headline, they're attacking into Lebanon. Lebanese troops in fierce battle with jihadists over a key border town. I know, right? Key question. Where the hell's Hezbollah in that? Hezbollah's off fighting against the al-Nusra Front in Syria, while the al-Nusra Front and ISIS join forces again in order to invade Lebanon? I thought Jordan was next. I guess they've decided they could start a civil war in Lebanon easier. Boy, there are a lot of factions to fight for what's theirs in Lebanon. If they think they can get that going again, I don't know. Boy, they talk about learning the hard way, though. Those people got to want to resist that kind of thing as best they can. But you know how people are when they react against suicide attacks and stuff. They can react really badly. That's why they work so well. So, anyway, Islamic State moving on there. And then fears of Yazidi genocide grow as over 450 were killed across Iraq in the last month. That's at antiwar.com/updates. Margaret Griffiths, she keeps track of all the Iraq casualties over all these years there. And the Yazidis are, I thought they were safe up in the Kurdish hills hiding. I don't know enough about the geography of it, but boy, they're on the run from the Islamic State now, that's for sure. If they're going to survive at all, I guess we'll see.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest today is Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA officer, and now he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com, the UNZ Review, UNZ.com, sometimes also at America.AlJazeera.com. The latest here for UNZ.com is Americans Should Be Ashamed, a modern Guernica enabled by Washington. And Phil, I forgot to say, you're the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Scott. Good to be back.
Good, good. Happy to have you here. So, first of all, before we get to the Palestine thing, I wanted to ask you about torture and the torture report real quick. I know we've discussed this before, but I think it's important for people to hear what you have to say about it. Obama has said, listen, we did torture some folks. And then he said, looking back, right, we're not supposed to look back, but now Obama says we can look back, I guess. Looking back, hey, geez, those guys were under a lot of pressure to torture people, and so they did, and so what are you going to do kind of thing, I guess, was what he meant to say. In other words, he's definitely still not going to prosecute anyone for it. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, I mean, that's the ultimate irony of the whole thing. I mean, this report can be as damning as it might be, but they're not willing to take any action on it. I mean, Obama has claims that he's forbidden torture. He claimed that he did that soon after he took office. So where's the accountability here? I mean, that's what bothers me. I had an interesting exchange with Ray McGovern, whom I know you've talked to, and I was speculating that maybe there's something really deeper that led to the CIA spying on the Senate committee. Maybe they thought they were going to find something that they really, really, really did not want them to find. I don't know, have any idea, and that's sheer speculation, but it's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way that they say it, the official story of that is that there was this Panetta report which proved that all the things that the Senate had concluded that the CIA was saying was not true actually was true. But then, yeah, like you're saying, who knows what that really entails?
Yeah, but, I mean, the point is, you know, the Panetta report, so what? It's not like anybody's going to jail. Brennan, at the worst, would have to resign if the bigger report had really come up with some damning stuff about the use of torture, which apparently it will have if it's ever released. But the fact is, there seems to be something more there. Why would you spy on a Senate committee knowing precisely what the consequences of that might be if there's really nobody going to be punished?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that really is a severe thing. I don't think you could overstate how big that is, that they're spying on the Intelligence Committee that way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, this is not like you do it and, oh, well, the boys will be boys and you get away with it. It's they would have known right from the get-go that this is a major, major assault on the balance of powers in the United States, and the consequences could be very grave. So why did they do it? And this is, I think, the question that's still kind of hanging out there.
Well, there's already such severe anecdotes here where they've tortured people to death and frozen to death and sick dogs on them and hung them upside down and kept them awake for weeks and beat the living hell out of them and all of these things in dungeons beneath Bangkok, Thailand. I mean, like some kind of nightmare, right? So I wonder if it's the murder charge or if it's the or I don't even know if the Senate committee report or the summary that they're even debating releasing even goes into this, but it seems like the most important thing here would be confirmation of what we really already know about the chain of command here, and that really it was the president, the vice president, and the national security cabinet are all absolutely indictable, guilty of felonies here.
Yeah, I mean, that could be. That certainly would be the political aspect of it that would be dynamite. And but, you know, I kind of suspect, since this, the Senate report already was prepared by a Democratic majority, but the Republicans would have had some say into what was going on, too. I can't see the government punishing anybody for anything anymore. I think there's always going to be some way of soft-soaping these issues to make it look like, next time, don't do it. So I don't know. That's why I suspect there might be some real bombshell out there still waiting.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, and that was Cheney's point all along, was to prove that there was no law that could bind the power of the president, especially during wartime. He can do anything. And, you know, as John Yoo said, that there's no law that would say that the president can't torture the child of a suspect in order to get at that suspect.
Yeah, so, that's right.
That's really just drawing the line in order to prove it can be crossed, and what are you going to do about it kind of thing. And like you said, there's not a prosecutor in America that's going to take this up because it goes too high up.
Right.
So, you know, it's a hell of a thing. Anyway, I wonder if someday, maybe soon, actually the real report, never mind the summary, will end up on WikiLeaks or something like that, and then we'll really see just how bad it was. But, I mean, what we already know, I remember that torture question on PBS, that documentary where they interviewed that guy, Tony Lugaranis, and he said, listen, man, forget Abu Ghraib. We tortured Iraqis here, there, and everywhere, and with a box and with a fox and in their house and in front of their kids and on the side of the road and in their backyard and for, you know, years on end, by the tens of thousands, we tortured the Iraqis. So, you know, don't tell me about, you know, one guy was made to stand on a box like he might be electrocuted or something. It went a hell of a lot further and deeper than that. They had suspended
the whole
idea of law.
Sure, I mean, it's inevitable in a system like that where they're condoning this kind of activity at one level. It's going to creep into every level, and that's what happens.
Yeah, well, that's probably a big part of the reason that on my list of things to ask you about today is the Islamic State and what used to be known as Iraq and how you think they're doing right now. I mean, of course, as Matthew Alexander, the interrogator, put it, most of the foreign fighters who he ever interrogated in Iraq said they were there because of the pictures of the torture. Here we are in 2014. They've now set up a state there.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the problem is the United States government has a real difficulty in recognizing that when you do something, there are consequences, and it feels itself immune. And, of course, you're absolutely right. And the other big issue, of course, is the Israeli occupation of Palestine that comes up again and again and again. When militants are interviewed after the fact to explain why they did what they did.
Yep. Well, and I want to give the whole second segment, really, to your Israel story here. But just a couple quick footnotes on the torture there, that actually Zawahiri and Zarqawi, and apparently now maybe Baghdadi, too, these guys all were tortured before they became the terrorists that they ended up becoming. Zarqawi was some two-bit rapist nobody before he was tortured by the Jordanians and then, you know, found religion and purpose in life, getting back at them.
And the other interesting story is that I don't know if you saw the piece I did on Turkey over at
I haven't read it yet. I have the tab here, but
yeah, but there's a presidential campaign going on there. The vote is on the 10th, and there have been serious allegations that Turkey and obviously the United States really were heavily into supplying initially the Al Qaeda linked groups. And then ISIS, just by virtue of the fact that, you know, they were kind of shipping in weapons and stuff like that and really didn't know who the hell was going to wind up with this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, you broke that story originally that Obama had signed that finding back in December of 2011, authorizing that kind of thing. And, yeah, I mean, it's always seemed that at the very least, it's you know, attempted plausible deniability that, oh, it's the Saudis that are sending all the money and we're trying to finance the moderates. But everybody knew that the moderates are basically ineffectual and all the money and the guns are ending up in the hands of the ISIS fighters. So it always seemed very deliberate to me, you know, all along. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. So there you go. Phil Giraldi, everybody, former CIA officer, now writing for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com. That's UNZ.com. Americans should be ashamed about the war on Gaza. Coming up next. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, writer for the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com and Al Jazeera. And his piece here, I'm reading it right now. Well, I just finished, actually. Here at the American Conservative Magazine, Erdogan tightens his grip on Turkey. That's at the American Conservative Magazine. And then here at UNS.com, Americans should be ashamed about the war in Gaza, the war against Gaza. And I'm sorry, because I need to give you time to talk about that, because you have a lot of important things in there, but it's all, you know, obviously tied together, but I want to give you a chance there, Phil, to elaborate on American slash Turkish slash Saudi, et cetera, support for the Mujahideen in Syria over the last couple of years, as you just mentioned there, if you want to.
Yeah, well, I mean, this whole thing started out basically, I guess it was a fantasy by Erdogan, the Turkish prime minister, who believed that intervening in Syria would get rid of the Assad regime and put in place a weaker, friendly sort of government that wouldn't be as closely tied to Iran. So he had this fantasy that this would actually happen. The Saudis, meanwhile, have been on his case for a long time, speaking of Assad's case, because Assad has a secular regime, and the Saudis, for reasons of their own, want something perhaps more fundamentalist, and they've been actively working against them. And the U.S., of course, came in on a two. Since 2003, we've been actively undermining the government in Damascus. So everybody came together on this. They expected this to be a quick one-off, and of course, now we have something that's been running for well over 2 years and has brought about 100,000 deaths. But of course, as usual, nobody's to blame.
Right. All right, now, but well, I'll try to be charitable about it. Let's say it was halfway through 2012, which I think is actually being very charitable. But let's say it was halfway through 2012 when it became absolutely apparent to everyone that this insurgency is in the hands of the al-Nusra Front, which has sworn its allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda, and these guys cut their prisoners' heads off, and they suicide bomb schools full of women and children, and they crucify their enemies in the town square. And they're the nice ones compared to the Islamic State that broke off from them, who are, I guess, more Iraqi-centered than Syrian-centered. But anyway, so then what? It sounds like the policy never changed as far as the Americans, the Turks, the Saudis continuing to back these guys anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the sensible thing would have been to basically make a concession, which was that Assad had a certain legitimacy and that you would have to negotiate with him in a serious way, recognizing that fact. But, of course, Washington couldn't bring itself to do that, and nor did the others in the equation. So what we've gotten is basically a continuous policy of supporting people that, under normal circumstances, we would not support ever. And this is a symptom of the dysfunction of Washington and of the Obama administration and of the State Department. And it's something I said we should be ashamed about Gaza, but we should also be ashamed about what's going on in Syria.
Mm. Yeah, because when you say if things were normal, you mean without the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. Did you see the clip of Michael Oren, who already had said this last October, but here he is on video with Jeffrey Goldberg on the stage at some Aspen, you know, hoity-toity thing, saying, hey, I know that the Sunnis, the Islamic State, they're the Al-Qaeda guys and everything, but I prefer them. He tries to say, but then he keeps saying the Israeli point of view, the government he's speaking for, our point of view is we prefer them to Hezbollah and Assad because they're backed by Iran.
Yeah, that's it. I saw that tape, and it's astonishing.
And, even Jeffrey Goldberg is like, hey, you're talking for yourself, pal.
Yeah, and it made absolutely no ripples in the mainstream media. It's like, this is, all right, we're telling, this guy is actually telling us why it is the way it is, and nobody cares.
Right. Yeah, even Obama had said to Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic that, yeah, the reason we're doing this is to take Iran down a peg. That's why, to support the rebellion against Assad in Syria, is because that is what Israel wants.
Yep.
Amazing. All right. So now talk to me about this war, because there's so much to say, and you wrote a whole great article here I hope everyone will read again. Americans should be ashamed at UNS.com. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the tendency is to look at Israel-Palestine as Israel-Palestine. But the fact is, this is a clear situation where there's, we can't call it necessarily a genocide, but it's certainly a massacre taking place. And that this was all engineered by the Israeli government. They knew that the three boys who were kidnapped were not kidnapped by Hamas, but and they knew that the boys were dead. But they still created a pretext for war. They went after Hamas, and when Hamas retaliated with these homemade rockets that didn't kill anyone, Israel went in with massive force and has killed something like 2,000 civilians at the current count, I think. And but the United States enabled all this. I mean, the United States has made a couple of squeaking noises about we wish they hadn't attacked a UN school where civilians were hiding, but then immediately turns around, resupplies the Israelis. And of course, the other secret story, which I didn't discuss in my article, is that the U.S. has been giving them all kinds of intelligence to kill more Palestinians. We are absolutely complicit in a massive war crime, and every American should be ashamed of what our government is doing. And while this is going on, Congress is voting unanimously to support Israel. Like the Palestinian lives don't mean anything. Like the fact that Israel initiated this war means nothing. I mean, it's just, and we give them $225 million more in money. Just incredible. Everybody I know is so mind-boggled, mind-blown by what's going on that they can't even comprehend how you can rationally even accept that this is the way the world works. I mean, it only works in the mind of Benjamin Netanyahu and Obama and his handlers.
It is. It's crazy. Now, so let me clarify what you say about the intel there. You're not just referring to Glenn Greenwald's piece, which is sort of historical. You're saying right now you know from your intelligence sources that America is helping Israel target Palestinians in Gaza?
I won't specify my sources, but let's just say that I know that the Israelis are receiving intelligence from the United States.
Right. But you're telling me you're not just reading that at The Intercept.
No.
All right. Well, I'll take that as confirmation of a damn horrible fact there, Phil. And so now talk to me very briefly, while you have almost no time at all, about the Council for the National Interest, which is the antidote to the lobby in Washington, D.C.
Well, we believe that none of this would be happening if there weren't an extremely powerful domestic lobby, the Israel lobby, that was pushing these agendas. And we work against them. We basically focus our efforts to demonstrate that America's interests and Israel's interests are not the same. And this is really the crux of the matter. I mean, every American citizen should realize, with even a tiny bit of common sense, that Israel and America don't have the same interests. And that doesn't mean we go to war with them or anything like that, or we punish them or anything like that. But the fact is that every decision a U.S. president makes should be based on American interests, not on those of Israel. So that's essentially what we try to get out, the message we try to get out. And I think people in America are starting to listen.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, you know, I don't know what all is making the difference. I guess I have to give a lot of credit to Twitter. I think that it really helps strike the balance between the news consumer and the news producer in a way that's brand new in American society. And they feel that pressure from their bias push right back again in such an instantaneous kind of way and in a consensus kind of a way where, anyway, you know what I mean, where you got one bad tweet with 100 responses getting it right. It becomes very hard for the mainstream media to keep up a lot of the old pretenses. They have to at least concede some of what's really going on. And, of course, people who have access to the internet in general have access to just kind of the basic information about what's going on here that's usually excluded from the news. And I mean, just the fact of the occupation at all, that they always
start
way after that.
Younger people, by and large, don't even pay attention to the mainstream media. There was a poll that came out yesterday that said that people under the age of 40 basically sympathize with the Palestinians. So there is a change that's coming, and I hardly ever read the mainstream media anymore, except to kind of laugh at it.
I
imagine you do too, but you know, it's just information is no longer being controlled as the way it was even 10 years ago, and as a result, a lot of people are going to make up their own minds about what they're seeing and hearing.
Yep. All right. Well, CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org is the website, y'all. It's a absolutely shameless plug because there ain't no shame in it at all. CNI helps sponsor this show, and I'm sure glad to support them. I'd say all the same stuff, even if you weren't, Phil, obviously. It's great work that you do, and I sure appreciate your time on the show as well.
Well, thank you, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's Phil Giraldi, formerly with the CIA. Now he writes for the American Conservative Magazine. That's the anti-war right for you there. And also UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com for the UNZ review. Again, the latest there is Americans should be ashamed about Israel's war on Gaza. And we'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is our friend Gareth Porter. He's got one in the National Interest. Take that, National Interest audience. Nationalinterest.org. Welcome back, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. Thanks very much. How are you?
Good, good. Happy to have you here. Now, listen, everybody. Gareth Porter writes primarily for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net, ipsnews.net. And we reprint just about all of it at antiwar.com. You can also find him at truthout.org. He won the Gellhorn Prize for his work on McChrystal and Petraeus' death squads in Afghanistan, which you got to read about. And also, he wrote the book Manufactured Crisis about how there never was an Iranian nuclear weapons program. The whole thing is a giant fake excuse for tension. And yet now I think you're reporting here at thenationalinterest.org. That may finally be changing, Gareth, huh?
Well, it is changing because for the first time in the history of U.S. Policy or relations with Iran or non-relations with Iran, the United States is now beginning to actually negotiate. And so the story that I, but not a story, but an article, an analysis that is in the National Interest really sort of covers this very interesting development in U.S. policy, historically very unusual, in which the U.S. did in fact end up for a few days actually negotiating with Iran after a few months of really maneuvering diplomatically using a lot of public diplomacy, meaning propaganda, public statements, and leaks to the press to try to put pressure on Iran. And the significance of this really is, as I see it, the following. That for decades, different U.S. administrations have essentially tried to use this idea of coercive diplomacy, which really means coercion. I mean, it doesn't mean diplomacy, it means coercion. But this term, coercive diplomacy, developed decades ago, really after the Cuban Missile Crisis, as a way of sort of prettifying the idea of the United States simply threatening other countries in order to get them to do what we want them to do. And so for decades, the U.S. policy has been built around coercion. And finally, the spring of this year, there were real negotiations supposedly towards a comprehensive agreement beginning. And in the period from May through June, the two rounds of negotiations, the U.S. was still using this sort of public threat to Iran that, you know, if you don't meet our demands for cutting your numbers of centrifuges very severely, then we'll walk away from the table and you won't get any agreement. And in response to that, the Iranians were playing their own diplomatic game, their own game of maneuvering by putting on the table demands that they knew were well beyond what they would get and what they really needed in an agreement. So ultimately, the result of this sort of public diplomacy by the Obama administration was that both sides were maneuvering both at the table and to some extent, at least in early July, through public statements. And I'm referring there to the fact that even the supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, ended up making a statement which was, in a way, his response to the public threats from the United States and their statements that Iran was not doing U.S. bidding. He then acted as though Iran was demanding, 190,000 SWU, or separative work units, meaning the equivalent of 190,000 primitive IR-1 centrifuges, as part of the negotiations, when in fact Iran's negotiator, Foreign Minister Zarif, had already talked to the Western negotiators, P5+1 negotiators, about a much more moderate, more modest demand. So what happens finally, and this is sort of the culmination of these talks, but it was as well a culmination of a long history of the United States refusing to really seriously negotiate with Iran. In July, you get the Zarif meetings with Kerry over two full days, July 13th, 14th, as I recall, maybe it was 12th, 13th. No, it was 13th, 14th. And in those 2 days of talks, it's clear that they really did seriously put their something closer to their minimum demands on the table, and we're moving toward a diplomatic solution mm-hmm. to the issue of Iran's nuclear program.
Right. So, in other words, it's just kind of the old commie dialectic, or really you could just say kind of traitors in the desert, right? Everybody starts with a tough position, and then you just move toward the center and work it out. Everybody on both sides knew what the other side really required and what would be reasonable. And so, like you're saying, as long as they were finally actually negotiating, the Americans, instead of just blustering and faking it like usual, then, hey, they were able to work something out here, it looks like.
Well, look, Scott, I mean, I think that the reality is that the Obama administration was working this idea of coercive diplomacy even in the May and June rounds of negotiations because, A, they believed that they had a critical advantage over Iran because they essentially viewed the economic sanctions against Iran's oil sector, the oil export sector, as so effective as a political instrument, as a diplomatic political instrument against Iran, that they believed that Iranians would not walk away from the table if the United States made that threat. They would actually make concessions if they made it look like the United States would walk away. So I think that they were playing that game, you know, at a much higher, much more intense level, and they were the ones who really initiated it. Mm-hmm. And I think the Iranians then did respond. But, you know, you're right. I mean, this is the normal procedure for both sides to advance demands that they know are much more ambitious than they're going to get, or at least somewhat more ambitious than they're going to get. I think this, in this case, the U.S. Started with a much more ambitious demand, which was they were talking about a few thousand centrifuges out of the 19,000 that Iran had deployed in their enrichment facilities, two enrichment facilities. And, you know, I think that they believed that they would get something close to that. And the Iranians, on the other hand, you know, knew that they would settle all along, as I think I've said on your program before. They would settle for essentially the 9,000 to 10,000 centrifuges that have actually been operating, and the other 9,000 or 10,000 that they have actually installed in the enrichment facilities. They never intended to operate, and they never hooked them up, and that was a clue which I think they clearly intended the Obama administration to pick up on, and I think the Obama administration did pick up on it, which is one of the reasons why, you know, the United States was insisting on going well beyond that to something like 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, at most 4,000, and they even allowed the French to put into the document that was being negotiated, the draft text of an agreement, of 500 or so as a number that was being demanded, putting it in brackets, of course. But it was another way of putting pressure on the Iranians. And, you know, in the end, I think the Americans knew that they, you know, if the Iranians refused to back down, that they would come back and reduce the demand.
All right, well, hold it right there, Gareth. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Gareth Porter. He's got a new one in the National Interest, nationalinterest.org, The Fog of Diplomacy, Creating a False Picture of the Iran Nuclear Talks. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. He writes for Interpress Service and truthout.org. Here he is at the National Interest, creating a false picture of the Iran nuclear talks. Well, debunking a false picture of the Iran nuclear talks. He's the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, the real context behind all of this. And I sure would like to see all of this wrap up. Now, so a couple of things I want to nail down about what you were saying. Gareth, you're saying, I think, that the American side, they're really playing hardball more than they should have up until very recently, really, before being willing to really compromise, and all because they thought that they had all this kind of momentum on their side because of all the sanctions. And I guess I thought that the sanctions were set to expire here pretty soon anyway, and that all of America's allies in Asia were already getting as many exemptions as they could and really wanted out from under the sanctions regime. And that wouldn't the Americans, do I have that wrong, or is that not part of it, that actually the Americans only had that particular gun to the Iranians' head for a limited amount of time before they expire, unlike, say, the old Iraq sanctions?
The sanctions weren't due to run out by any means. Only the only thing that was going to happen after, you mean after the period of negotiation that had just expired last month on the 20th, right?
Well, yeah, and you know what? I admit that I'm ignorant as to all the different layers of sanctions at the international level and at the U.S. level and et cetera. But
Yeah, I mean, there was a very limited slice of sanctions benefits that the Iranians were getting during that six-month, whatever it was, period, yeah, from last November.
You mean after the interim deal was signed last November?
After the interim deal, uh-huh, with 8 months. That was actually due to expire. But
the relief was set to expire.
But the sanctions regime itself were, of course, not going to expire as of July 20th. In fact, that would, you know, even if they had reached an actual comprehensive agreement, my understanding, certainly, I'm quite sure about this, is that the U.S. was going to insist that the sanctions would be dismantled over time, gradually. So, you know, in other words, as Iran was carrying out various stages of the agreement, the sanctions would be reduced, and that's the way it was going to work. So it would last for years beyond even a comprehensive agreement.
And that goes for all the UN sanctions that Korea and Japan and Australia are participating into, not just the American sanctions.
I mean, the sanctions that Japan and Korea are part of are really they're sanctions that were essentially negotiated between the U.S. and those governments. I mean, the governments basically responded to pressure from the United States based on its ability to say, if your banks don't do what we want them to do, or refuse to do, I should say, that is to say, have anything to do with Iran's foreign earnings from oil exports, mm-hmm, we will punish your banks. They won't be able to do business with our banks, and we will exact a very heavy toll financially on your country. So that's really the basis for getting all of these countries that were purchasers of Iranian oil on board. That's the only reason they did it, essentially.
I got it. And then, so I'm sorry, man. It's not like this is even in your article, but I guess I had thought that they had already said that they were only willing to go along with this for so long, and you know, we're already trying to pull back.
Well, no, I don't think that there was never statements by China, by Korea, Japan, and European countries, and India, for example, that they would terminate the sanctions if agreement wasn't reached within a certain period of time. But I think the sense was, you know, the body language, if you will, was that these sanctions could not last forever if, in fact, the Iranians were willing to play ball and, have a position which was reasonable on their nuclear program. I mean, that's not by any means explicitly stated anywhere. That's my interpretation of what I've read about it.
Right, I get it. Okay, so now, assuming that they get this deal, that they're able to iron out the last of the supposed outstanding issues and all of that, how significant is that really going to be for the relationship between America and Iran, you know, changing over, say, the near term, medium term?
Scott, that is the $64 gazillion question in my mind, and I know in many other people's minds. And I certainly don't know the answer, but I have to say that my sense of the trend line in regard to U.S. and Iran has been shifting in recent months. And I do believe now that that reaching an agreement would signal a development of a longer-term trend toward reducing the enmity between the United States and Iran, and toward, at the beginning, more sort of sub rosa, unannounced, informal cooperation with Iran, but working gradually towards something more than that. In other words, I think that the fundamental nature of Middle East politics is such that no administration can continue to ignore the fact that the United States and Iran share far more political strategic interests than the United States shares with any other country in the Middle East. I mean, you know, of course, you know, Israel is our formal ally, but if you stop to look at the reality, I mean, that relationship has cost the United States far more than it has been worth. And the only reason that it's continued, really, is domestic politics. So,
now at this point, if we really become too good of friends with Iran, I worry that's going to make our position that much worse. I mean, for example, if we have, well, right now they're talking about flying drones as air cover from Kurdistan for combined Iraqi and Kurdish forces against the Islamic State. But those Iraqi forces are backed by the Quds Force and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, which has members there in Iran advising Maliki. And it sort of seems like, as bad as that mess is, and as much as it's all the American government's fault, we ought to stay the hell out of taking anybody's side in that thing right now. If they want to exhaust themselves, too bad. But what if America's outright providing air cover for Iran against the Sunnis in Iraq? That's going to lead to a whole new shockwaves and consequences around the region,
You know what my position is going to be on that question, and it is the same as yours. Can I guarantee that something along those lines would not happen in the future with regard to an increasingly, I don't want to say close, but not unfriendly relationship between the United States and Iran? I can't, but I do believe that there are significant constraints politically within the national security state on a return to, you know, any serious warfare in Iraq. I don't think that it would be an open and shut case. I mean, when you get Petraeus, for example, saying publicly that it would be a bad idea for the United States to be, you know, carrying out airstrikes in Iraq, I think that is a signal that you've got much more fundamental opposition within the military leadership to that idea. And so I think that, you know, the constraints that we've seen operating with regard to Iran and in regard to Syria, certainly coming from the Pentagon and from the military, from the Joint Chiefs, I think that applies more or less to Iraq as well. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but that's my sense.
Man, I sure hope that's right. I guess it still remains to be seen.
It remains to be seen, indeed.
It sort of seems to me like they can't help it but want to go and bomb these guys, but I sure hope that they can. I sure hope that they're
learning a lesson. Well, I think, you know, again, you're going to differentiate here between the interests of the Air Force, which is always looking for its next war, and presumably would look kindly upon that idea, and the Army, Navy, and Marines, which would be much more skeptical about it.
Right. Good point. Yeah, they've paid their price in blood. What'd they get for it? Nothing, so.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks, Gareth. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. That's the great Gareth Porter. The book is Manufactured Crisis. Buy it. And the article is at the National Interest, nationalinterest.org, creating a false picture of the Iran nuclear talks.